Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran says any groundwork for increasing Washington's role in regional security mechanisms will only lead to instability and the spread of terrorism. Japanese voting in shock and grief. Polls open across Japan for an upper house election just 2 days after the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Also ahead, Sri Lanka's President Gotabaya Rajapaksa announces his resignation hours after protesters chased him from his residence and set on fire the house of the Prime Minister. Thank you for joining us. Iran slams as provocative a plan by the U.S. to advance partnership for air defense among Washington's allies in the Middle East. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said Washington raises such issues in an attempt to create Iranophobia and discord among regional countries, while it has no proper understanding of the realities on the ground. Kanani noted attempts to create new security concerns in the region will have no result other than tension and insecurity. He said promoting Iranophobia will not create a safe margin for Israel, adding any groundwork for increasing the role of the U.S. in regional security mechanisms will only lead to instability and the spread of terrorism. On Thursday, White House spokesman John Kirby said U.S. officials are discussing ways of integrating air defense capabilities with regional leaders in the face of what he called a threat from Iran. This days ahead of the U.S. president's visit to Saudi Arabia and Israel. Muslims in many countries around the world are celebrating Eid al-Adha that marks the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage. Thousands of Indonesians celebrated the occasion with prayers. Iran and many countries elsewhere in the world are set to mark Eid al-Adha later on Sunday, slaughtering a sacrificial animal as part of the ceremonies to mark the occasion. That's done in remembrance of the Prophet Abraham's readiness to sacrifice his son in obedience to God. Many other countries celebrated the event on Saturday. In Palestine, thousands performed the Eid prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds. Muslims in other regional countries, including Afghanistan, Jordan, Egypt, Oman, Kazakhstan, and Turkey, celebrated the event too. The exact date of Eid al-Adha depends on lunar sightings and varies by country. Israel's medical association is assisting the regime in torturing Palestinians in the occupied territories. That's according to U.S.-based rights group Physicians for Human Rights. The group says it has listed the role of doctors who help in the torture of Palestinians by Israel's Shin Bet agency. There are more measures by the Israeli Medical Association, too. The rights body says the association denies Palestinian medical staff the right to safety during the regime's raids. It also prevents Palestinian patients from receiving health care. Physicians for Human Rights says the Israeli association is complicit in the regime's ethical failures and gross violations of human rights. The group says it has already filed a complaint with the International Medical Syndicate against the Israeli association. Earlier, we were joined by Mechaimer Abu Sada, who is a professor of political science at Al-Azhar University. He says the report by the U.S.-based rights group is a first in its kind, and that's disturbing for the Israeli regime. Take a listen.
Over the past 55 years since the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories, West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, many Palestinian detainees have died inside Israeli jails. As I just mentioned to you last week, a Palestinian woman died inside Israeli jail as a result of ill treatment. Let me just also add another point, that there are several incidents in which Israeli occupation forces shoots Palestinian civilians across the West Bank and East Jerusalem and allow them to bleed until death and prevent Palestinian medical staff from reaching them or providing medical service to those bleeding Palestinian who were shot by Israeli forces. The new report by the U.S.-based human rights group is definitely a disturbing report for Israel, in which that accuses Israel Medical Association of collaborating with the Israeli Shin Bet intelligence agency and providing cover for such ill treatment and inhumane practices by Israel.
Polls open across Japan for the upper house of the parliament elections, which is overshadowed by the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. The vote is expected to expand a majority of Abe's ruling Liberal Democratic Party and its coalition partner. The party already enjoys a solid majority in parliament. The vote takes place just 2 days after Abe was assassinated while on the campaign trail. The suspect is in custody and has told investigators he targeted Abe because he believed the politician was linked to an unnamed organization. The head of police in the area where Abe was killed has admitted there were undeniable flaws in security for the former prime minister. The murder of Japan's best-known politician Shinzo Abe rattles the country and sends shockwaves around the world. Let's check out some reactions posted online.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another hashtag trending. On Friday morning, an unusual act of political violence shocked Japan and the whole world. Japan's longest-running modern leader, Shinzo Abe, was gunned down while delivering a campaign speech. Abe was assassinated by a 41-year-old man in a deed decried by the political establishment as an attack on democracy itself, shocking a country where guns are tightly controlled and political violence is almost unthinkable. Abe had been making a campaign speech outside a train station when two shots rang out. The assassination sent shockwaves throughout the world as post-war Japan prides itself in its orderly democracy. Our first tweet of the day comes from Marikong. Perhaps ordinary Japanese people, me included, worry a lot more about earthquakes than gun incidents. That's why the assassination of Mr. Abe was all the more shocking. We were naive in believing it can't happen here. Antoine Fletcher said, assassination is a grotesque act of cowardice. It should not be celebrated or encouraged. It is the murder of a man by a scoundrel unwilling to fight the armies who stand behind the assassinated. And over here, a comment by John Hernlund reads, the assassination of Shinzo Abe is a terrible tragedy. I want to express my condolences to all Japanese people who have worked hard to build and maintain a peaceful society without this kind of political violence. The assassin will not succeed in destroying these achievements. Tina has our next tweet, still in shock about former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's assassination. Violent crimes in Japan are very rare, which has truly rattled this country's sense of identity as a peaceful country. There are conflicting reports about the probable motives behind the assassination of Shinzo Abe, but investigative sources say that the suspect had a grudge against a specific organization, possibly a religious group, that he believed was linked to Abe. Our next comment says, before the assassination of Shinzo Abe, the most recent political assassination in Japan was in 1960, when a 17-year-old assassinated the leader of the Socialist Party with a sword. Julia Mio Inuma has our next comment. The assassination of Japanese leader Shinzo Abe rocked a country where strict firearms laws mean gun violence is almost unheard of, as a procession of mourners laid flowers near the site of the shooting to honor the country's longest-serving prime minister. Imran Khan tweeted, Shinzo Abe death. The murderer's heart was filled with hatred for the religious organization Shinzo Abe was associated with, the real reason behind the murder. Shinzo Abe's assassination, know why the murderer killed Shinzo Abe, said to be hated the religious group. Messages of sympathy and shock poured in from around the world following the news of Abe's death, including ones from the neighboring Taiwan, China, and Russia, as well as from across Asia, Europe, and the Americas. Abe is best known for his Abenomics policy of aggressive monetary easing and fiscal spending. Our final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Alive. Whoever planned this already failed with Abe's assassination. This will further strengthen ideas of Abe about reconsidering the position of Japan post-1945 socially and militarily. This incident will speed up Japan's move towards a more anti-China and non-US-based security apparatus. Dr. Samuel Chapman has our next tweet. In the same way that mass shootings inspire copycats in America, I worry that Abe's assassination will do the same, but in other countries, not just Japan. It seems like it was a shocking, flagrant, egotistical attack, just like a mass shooting, so ripe for copying. Tom Boatman tweets, tweeted, apparently Yamagami, Abe's killer, was upset with Abe being an advocate of the cult-like Unification Church of Japan, Toitsu Kyokai, which Yamagami believed ruined his life. Japan's mainstream media is downplaying or simply not understanding this point. And our final comment comes from Pamela Valmont. Abe's assassination and Johnson's deposing are symptomatic of a much deeper plus more terrifying problem, approaching economic disaster in those countries who choose to implement sanctions against Russia. Winter cold, food rationing, plus shortages, plus no heating gas, plus petrol looming. That's a wrap for another Hashtag Trending. Thank you for sticking around. Until next time.
Welcome back. And the latest in Sri Lanka, the country's president has agreed to step down just hours after demonstrators stormed into his house to protest the economic meltdown. Parliament Speaker says President Gotabaya Rajapaksa will step down on July 13th to ensure peaceful transition of government. This follows fresh demonstrations during which protesters set the Prime Minister's house on fire, despite his offer to resign following the biggest day of rallies. Also on Saturday, thousands of protesters stormed the president's house and offices, forcing him to flee his home. Protesters want both the prime minister and the president to resign. This following months of mounting public anger over the worst economic crisis the country has witnessed in decades. Hundreds shouted slogans against the president. Military personnel and police were unable to hold the crowds back, even after using water cannon and tear gas. Nearly 40 people have been injured as a result of clashes. The capital city has been the scene of demonstrations since April. Protesters are blaming the government for the economic hardships they are facing. Sri Lanka has been crippled by a shortage of foreign exchange, with people struggling to pay for fuel, food, and medicine. The island nation has sought an International Monetary Fund bailout to secure funds for essential commodities. Jihan Pereira is chief of Sri Lanka's National Peace of Council. He attended the Colombo protests earlier today and then spoke to us about the ongoing rallies and people's demands for change in their country.
The mood is quite jubilant at this time. Footage of people going into the president's house and occupying it. They are taking a swim. They are touring it. Hopefully, they will not vandalize it. I'm very hopeful that that will not happen. But they have been able to breach that. And what this means is that it shows that the government is unable to resist the people's protest. And I'm hopeful that, now, there is no constitutional way to force the president out. There's a very long process of impeachment. But also the people want the parliament also. They want the government in its entirety to go. The president plus the government, which is dominated by the president's party, they want them to go. And I have a feeling that that is going to happen now. And what we are moving towards is an all-party government, a small all-party government. Maybe it excludes the present the ruling family and the ministers of this present government, but it's going to be a small all-party government for a temporary period to try and get over the hump.
Argentines have taken to the streets of Buenos Aires to protest against the agreement between the government of President Alberto Fernandez and the International Monetary Fund. The protesters carried banners and placards that read, "Out with the IMF," and "No to paying the debt," saying the international financial institution brings them nothing but misery and dependency. Argentina recently reached a deal with the IMF to restructure a $44 billion bailout. While the government says the agreement will not affect social spending, the opponents say the deal largely burdens people. Last week, Economy Minister Martin Guzman resigned amid tensions on how to handle the economic crisis. Inflation in Argentina is running above 60%, while the South American country is experiencing a fall of its currency's value and an unstable financial market. Moving on to the war in Ukraine, where Russian troops are seeking to push deeper into the eastern Donbass region, the current focal point of the battle. Ukrainian authorities say several parts of Donetsk are now under Russian shelling. They say five people have lost their lives over the past day. The city of Sloviansk is being shelled too. Meanwhile, Washington says it's sending $400 million in additional military supplies to Kiev. The U.S. and its allies have already sent billions of dollars in weapons packages to Ukraine. They have also imposed several rounds of sanctions on Moscow. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that continued bans could lead to catastrophic energy price rises in Europe. Russia's foreign minister has also accused the West of preventing Kiev from seeking a peace deal. Addressing a G20 meeting, Lavrov scolded Western powers for wasting an opportunity to tackle global economic issues. Skepticism abounds in the EU around the idea that relations between the 27-nation bloc and Britain will improve once Prime Minister Boris Johnson leaves office. Brussels and London remain at loggerheads over post-Brexit trading arrangements relating to Northern Ireland. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace, just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but he didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like, Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the Limelight.
Not a day passes when U.S. armed forces, whether the mostly white police in American towns and cities or whether Yankee occupation soldiers abroad, do not indulge in acts of sadistic terrorism, says Kahan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Terrorism and Human Rights Violations, Hallmark of U.S. Regime. Stay tuned for more. Not a day passes when U.S. armed forces, whether the mostly white police in American towns and cities or rather Yankee occupation soldiers abroad, do not indulge in acts of sadistic terrorism. As a matter of fact, there is no conception of human rights in official American thinking from the White House to the ordinary white-skinned cops notorious for their blood-curdling violation of all civilizational norms. For instance, this heartlessness was on full display last week in Akron, Ohio, where a 25-year unarmed old Afro-American citizen was killed for no fault in the most brutal manner. White traffic policemen, on mere suspicion, gave a 7-minute chase to motorist Jalen Walker and after cornering him, pumped at least 60 bullets into his body, even though he had neither committed any crime nor violated the rules of the road. A couple of years ago, U.S. racist brutality had shocked the civilized world when George Floyd was mercilessly throttled to death in broad daylight in the streets of Minneapolis by white policemen for being a black-skinned person. This is law enforcement of U.S. style, or actually the trampling of justice on the pretext of safeguarding security, which not just frequently happens in the streets of American towns and cities, but occurs with untold brutalities in countries where Yankee soldiers are based. This happened in Dresden, Berlin, and other German towns when the Nazi army collapsed during the Second World War and the victorious U.S. troops plundered people, murdered children, and gang-raped women. The Japanese were also subjected to these inhuman U.S. atrocities in the Eastern Theater of the War, and later the Koreans. These were routine occurrences for over a decade in Vietnam, where Americans committed every conceivable crime, while resorting to hypocrisy at the UN and other world forums by falsely claiming to be supporters of human rights. In our times, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria have witnessed these cruelties by the American soldiers and their agents, while regimes that slavishly serve U.S. interests have enacted the same scenarios in Palestine, Yemen, Bahrain, Egypt, and other places. Meanwhile, ever since the triumph of the Islamic Revolution that kicked out the American hegemons in 1979, Washington has continued to target Iran with all kinds of terrorism, including economic, cultural, pharmaceutical, and political, including the 8-year war it has imposed in 1980s through Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad, who earned lasting damnation for using internationally banned chemical weapons supplied by the U.S. and the West. Yet, despite this grave violation of human rights and dignity, the U.S. claims to be a defender of human rights, a baseless claim that is dismissed by experts. In the words of the Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, the United States is by no means qualified to talk about the issue of human rights. Kazem Gharibabadi said on the sidelines of the 4th International Conference on the American Human Rights, from the perspective of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, this government, meaning the U.S. regime, should be held accountable by the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation. As Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Baqir Kani said during the same confab in Tehran, one can confidently claim that there is no nation in today's world that has not tasted the bitter taste of the American version of human rights. In short, the world will not be a safe place to live in, and people around the world, including in America, will not be allowed to lead a peaceful life with human dignity until history's greatest violators of human rights, whether Democrat or Republican regimes, exist in Washington and indulge freely in the most gruesome acts of terrorism at home and abroad.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one outstanding decision from the side of Iraq's most prominent Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who insisted on its state of neutrality concerning the makeup of the Iraqi future government. We know that they're establishing a new government in Iraq now, and the people have voted for that. But Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani stated of neutrality in that part. Sayyid Mohsen, now let's start with you this episode. Why do you think Ayatollah al-Sistani decided such a decision?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, we can see the main role of Ayatollah Sistani, that he has the role of a leadership amongst the Iraqi nationals, basically. And we can see the way he have saved his nation from the threat of ISIS.
That's right.
You know, when he gave the fatwa of everyone should come out and the need to protect themselves and the need to come out for Iraq, basically.
That's right.
And the Sunnis, his fatwa about the Sunnis, that they are just like our body parts. Yes. They're just a part of us, basically. That's what he had. So basically, his status is above all these political, we can say, you know, the fights or the differences that we can see within the political groups. And actually, in Islam, when we look at the Islamic system, within the Islamic system, we have the system of Imam and Ummah, like the leader and the followers, basically.
Yes.
Under this system, which is the basic system of, we can say, Islam, and especially in Shiaism, we follow this system. Ayatollah Sistani is playing the role of the leader at the moment for his nation. And when he's playing the role, then there is no grouping for the followers. But obviously, we are following a secular system where we have this democracy and, you know, these political systems, right and left, I don't know, the Republican and the other ones. So the decision that he made is a wise decision.
Yes.
And those even who are criticizing him basically are unknown to what he is capable of, basically.
That's right.
And they want him to get involved in the little things, little issues that they have in between them, which can be solved by the political, we can say, groups by themselves.
Okay.
And there is no need of him supporting anyone.
That's all right. And especially when we look at the country Iraq, we see our Sunni brethren also living over there, you know. And Ayatollah Sistani has always emphasized on the unity among different denominations inside Iraq and all the Muslim lands. And that's why he had made an international figure regarding from the Shia world in Islam. But Said Murtaza, again, you know, this is when, you know, out of the total seats of the, we can say the parliament, in the parliamentary elections, the Shia ones have won the chairs over there. And Ayatollah Sistani is a Shia, so automatically and technically speaking, it was expected for from Ayatollah Sistani to support, you know, the Shia ones over there. But he has stated neutrality, again, not getting into the political games and the political scene of Iraq. But at the same time, behind the scene, he has this power of issuing a fatwa against ISIS and Daesh and all the people from different denominations, not only the Shia and the Sunni, but also the non-Muslims come to the scene following him. So this is the power of the Marja'iyya in Iraq. Talk a little bit about this for us.
Well, you know, we have to just again look into the issue of election from two different points of views.
Okay.
First, we know that election looks like a political game.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone involved in the political game puts his political purpose first before any other factors. And we know that Muslims around the world have the same system somehow these days, that they are very much involved in the political issues. And election is one of them.
That's right.
As a kind of election expert, because I used to work with election commission in some countries in Africa and in Asia.
That's right.
I would like to say that the election is a technical process. We have technical campaigns. We have political supports from political parties. But the story looks a little bit different inside Iraq, because I was actually somehow involved in the election for the first time that took place after that Saddam Hussein as a dictator toppled.
Okay.
So we have this constituency election. We had this constituency election there.
Yes.
You know, we should not forget the great influence and the role of Shia authorities. And this great Marja inside Iraq is not going to belittle mm-hmm. himself and his role as the only leader who is going to bring the whole nation together when the situation is getting tough.
That's right.
And we had this actually done by Grand Ayatollah Sistani.
Yes.
And, you know, political game is not a ground for scholars to play.
Yes.
So what they did was a great achievement mm-hmm. For the Shia scholars.
Yes.
Because basically, we need to look at the bigger picture. What stands more important than anything else inside the country?
Yes.
National integrity and national unity.
Yes.
So if these two factors have been kept and they have been actually maintained,
yes.
especially by a religious scholar,
yes.
it would certainly give this interpretation to every single individual in the country that the whole nation is together,
yes.
and they are not going to be divided.
That's right.
Let's look if the other things would happen.
Mm-hmm.
If this Grand Ayatollah would actually take a side
mm-hmm.
In the election, so the whole nation will actually fall apart.
Yes.
So and the system probably will collapse.
Okay.
So in order to prevent more damages, greater damages to the national interest and to the even to the religious interest.
That's right.
So I think great Ayatollah al-Sistani made a great decision.
Yes, that's right.
And he and his office openly announced that they're not going to take any sides,
yes.
but they're going to actually look at the whole election
right.
process that must be fair.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, we have actually different segments,
yes.
political segments
yes.
in the country that each won some seats.
That's right. Okay. And Said Mohsen, do you think that this decision of Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani will make a kind of religious unity among the Sunni and Shia inside Iraq too?
It is definitely. Obviously, we have these different groups. We should not forget we have Kurds, we have the Sunni denomination, we have the Shia denomination. And as Said Murtaza has mentioned, the scholars, they should not enter into the political, you know, games that the politicians generally have, the groups have, because They come with their own personal, we can say, like, inclinement towards, you know, the thoughts that they have.
That's right.
They have their own plans. And tomorrow, if something goes wrong, the very first person who's going to be blamed is not the political party. It's going to be the Grand Ayatollah.
Yes.
So it was a wise and great decision that he made. And obviously, this will bring unity. And tomorrow, if anything happens or any, we can say, like, if there is a dispute among these parties, Ayatollah Sistani will be the one who can solve these issues the way he did before.
Okay.
You know, obviously, we need to leave a space for someone who can resolve the issues the political parties if tomorrow, if something happens and the Iraqi nation needs someone.
Mm-hmm.
So basically,
why is independent reasoning for himself?
Yes.
You know, on presence.
And this is a big decision because tomorrow they will not go after America to come and do decision, make decision amongst us.
Yes.
They have their own personality. They have their own leader. Or a grand Ayatollah who can basically make decision for themselves. So yes, it is the matter. It is. It will bring a unity amongst all the communities, and obviously, it increases the respect of the Shia school of thought as well.
That's right.
That when such a person at a high state of a school of thought, he plays a role neutral in the election, where everything should be neutrally, should be resolved neutrally according to the process which has been defined. So therefore, the unity will increase and the respect amongst the people will increase definitely.
That's all right. And this, as you said, from the side of the Hawza of Najaf, and you know, the Zaim, the main Zaim of the Hawza of Najaf, you know, and all the Shia houses inside Iraq comes, that is Ayatollah al-Sistani. You know, this position has shown that, again, Ayatollah al-Sistani is emphasizing on the national unity and the integrity of Iraq. And as you said, in the harsh decisions that are made, for example, the attack that ISIS made on Iraq, you know, such a personality can really help the people over there. But say, Murtaza, the case is that the Shias inside Iraq are now getting the chairs out of the parliament, the majority of the chairs out of the parliament. But again, they must not be proud of this power. Is it so? Because in the next elections, something else might happen. And I think this power shift inside Iraq and the balance has to be taken care of because the population over there is not the only Shia one.
Well, you know that if you look at the primary results of the count, you would see that the whole ballot papers have been counted, and the political parties, usually the three major ones, won some seats from this election.
Yes.
And the only political party that won actually like two-thirds of the seats were the Shiite ones.
Yes.
And it shows that the majority of the people, the majority of the eligible voters actually voted for the Shiites.
That's right.
So it shows that it's a great opportunity for the Shiite political parties, not only one, because we have another political Shiite political party that won around 37 seats.
Yes.
So altogether, it's more than like 100 seats,
yes.
And it was allocated to the Shiite political parties. Yes. It's a great opportunity. It shows that Shiites must take this opportunity and use it in order to benefit the whole Iraqi nation.
Iraqi nation.
And, you know, in Iraq, we have other religions too,
yes.
other followers too.
Yes.
We have even Christians.
Yes.
We have other
yes.
followers of other religions. So Shiite must draw a very authentic picture of religious freedom.
Yes.
Unfortunately, religious freedom is not a popular term in Western parts of the world. So they say we don't have religious freedom. But what has been happening in some countries like Iraq now, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and some other countries, we have religious freedom.
Yes.
So this freedom must be practiced.
Yes.
And I think Shiite political parties now has that chance, and they have to grab that chance and to show to other followers of other religions that Shiites are not very much closed-minded.
Yeah, so even inside Islamic Republic of Iran's parliament, we have representatives from the Sunni Brethren, from Zoroastrians, from we can say the even the Kalimi ones, you know, the Armenians, you know, they have their own representative inside our parliament inside Iran.
So this shows that the Grand Ayatollah Sistani made a very effective decision, and his role is not going to be ignored in order to increase, advance, boost national unity and national integrity.
Okay, Said Mohsen, any comment?
I just wanted to add that, when we see Ayatollah Sistani being neutral, we should, when we're talking about the election of the Iraq, we should also have a neutral role, or maybe let's take out this discussion from the sectarian, you know, discussion from a general discussion that the Iraqi nation had the election.
Yes.
There are some parties, you know, obviously the parties, maybe they're like Shia and Sunni. We are just saying that, but I think it's not good to mention Shia and Sunni.
Really?
Well, a party has won most of the votes because, you know, if you look at the population, Shias are in majority.
Yes.
So if we say like they have won more seats, and what about the Sunnis? This is not good.
Okay.
Basically, in Iraq, there's a special like party which is related to the Sadr family.
Yes.
There are the other parties which are related to other tribes. Because another thing in Iraq, we have this tribal system as well. So basically, if we put forward this word as that most of the, you can say like the votes or the seats have been taken by the Sadr tribe, and this party has taken it, that would be better, rather than saying if Shias are coming, what's going to happen, or Ayatollah Sistani is Shia, because, you know, the role and the statement of Ayatollah Sistani tells us or teaches us that you should not use such words, because you should use a word which tells, like, within Iraq there are two parties, and a party has got more votes, what he can do.
But any group, regardless of any, we can say, sectarian look that we have, if comes to the power, has to observe the rise of all in
that's,
Iraq,
that's
whether
important.
It be in Sunni or Shia one. That's why. Okay, this is the point. Thank you, my Said Mohsen and Said Murtaza, for presence in the program Viewpoints. We talked about Grand Ayatollah Sistani's decision on its state of being neutral concerning the makeup of the future government in Iraq. It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Iyan Kalav Islam page. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Kalav Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature.
وناديناه أن يا إبراهيم قد صدقت الرؤيا إنا كذلك نجزي المحسنين.
And we called out to him saying, O Ibrahim, you have indeed shown the truth of the vision. Surely thus do we reward the doers of good. Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, celebrates and honors the willingness of Prophet Ibrahim, peace be upon him, to sacrifice his firstborn son Ishmael as an act of obedience to God's command. We here at IRIB English Radio congratulate all of our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., some Republicans see an opening for a post-Trump candidate in the 2024 presidential election, with so many of Donald Trump's endorsed candidates falling to defeat in recent primaries. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Shane Goldmacher, Maggie Haberman, and Rachel Shorey. The piece is titled Trump's Primary Losses Puncture His Invincibility. Stay with us for more. Donald J. Trump has cast this year's primaries as a moment to measure his power, endorsing candidates by the dozen as he sought to maintain an imprint on his party unlike any other past president. But after the first phase of the primary season concluded on Tuesday, a month in which a quarter of America's states cast their ballots, the verdict has been clear. Donald Trump's aura of untouchability in Republican politics has been punctured. In more than 5 years, from when he became president in January of 2017 until May of 2022, Donald Trump had only ever seen voters reject a half a dozen of his choices in Republican primaries. But by the end of this month, that figure has now more than doubled, with his biggest defeat coming on Tuesday when Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia thrashed a Trump-backed challenger by more than 50 percentage points. Three other Trump recruits challenging Kemp allies also went down to defeat. The mounting losses have emboldened Donald Trump's rivals inside the Republican Party to an extent not seen since early 2016 and increased the chances that, should he run again in 2024, he would face serious competition. I think a non-Trump with an organized campaign would have a chance, said Jack Kingston, a former Georgia congressman who advised the first Trump presidential campaign. Donald Trump remains broadly popular among Republicans and has a political war chest well north of $100 million. But there has been a less visible sign of slippage. Trump's vaunted digital fundraising machine has begun to slow down. An analysis by the New York Times shows that his average daily online contributions have declined every month for the last 7 months that federal data is available. Donald Trump has gone from raising an average of $324,633 per day in September of 2021 on WinRed, the Republican donation processing portal, to $202,185 in March of 2022, even as he ramped up his political activities and profile. Those close to Donald Trump and even Republicans who aren't caution against misreading the significance of primary losses in which he himself was not on the ballot. Governor Brian Kemp, for instance, took pains not to say a cross word about the former president to avoid alienating his loyal base. To be the man, you have to beat the man, said Jim Hobart, a Republican pollster with Public Opinion Strategies. And until Trump either bows out of electoral politics or is beaten by a Republican at the ballot box, his strength remains. Rivals, including his own former Vice President Mike Pence, are gearing up for a potential presidential run as he and others visit key early states like Iowa and ramp up their own fundraising operations. Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida has amassed a $100 million re-election war chest and is the talk of many donors, activists and voters interested in the future of Trumpism without Donald Trump. Donald Trump had 4 good years, said Cole Muzio, president of the Frontline Policy Council, a conservative Christian group based in Georgia, who voted twice for Mr. Trump, but but is now looking for someone more forward-looking. Ron DeSantis is great about seeing where the left is going and playing on the field that they're going to be on, rather than reacting to what happened a couple of years ago, Mr. Muzio said, echoing the frustration that Donald Trump continues to obsess about denying his 2020 election loss. Cole Muzio, whose organization is hosting former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at his fall gala headliner, spoke as he waited to hear Mike Pence this week in Kennesaw, Georgia, at a rally for Brian Kemp, all names he included in the party's deep bench of 2024 alternatives. Donald Trump still remains the most coveted endorsement in his party, and he has boosted some big winners. Sarah Huckabee Sanders in Arkansas virtually cleared the field for governor with Donald Trump's support, and Representative Ted Budd in North Carolina defeated a past governor to win his party's Senate nomination. Yet the difficult primary season has added to Donald Trump's personal anxieties about his standing, after he has sought to fashion himself as something of an old-school party boss in his post-presidency. He has told advisers he wants to declare his candidacy or possibly launch an exploratory committee this summer. Most of Donald Trump's advisers believe he should wait until after the midterm elections to announce a candidacy. Yet the sense among Republicans that Mr. Trump has lost political altitude is taking hold, including among some of those close to Trump himself. Taylor Bodewich, a Trump spokesman, said the undeniable reality is that Republicans rely on Donald Trump to fuel Republican victories in 2022 and beyond. President Trump's political operation continues to dominate American politics, raising more money and driving more victories than any other political organization, bar none, Mr. Bodewich said. Some Republican strategists have fixated on the fact that so many of Donald Trump's endorsees have landed about one-third of the vote. Big winners, J.D. Vance in Ohio. Losers, Jody Heiss in Georgia, Janice McGeechin in Idaho, and Charles Herbster in Nebraska. And those headed for a recount. Dr. Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania. One-third of the party is at once an unmatched base of unbending loyalists, and yet a cohort far from a majority. Notably, Donald Trump's share of what is raised overall among all Republicans online has also declined. Mr. Trump's main fundraising committee accounted for 19.7% of what was raised by Republican campaigns and committees on Win Red in the last 4 months of 2021, but just 14.1% of what was raised during the first 3 months of 2022. Some of that decrease is the result of other candidates on the ballot raising more this year. Still, only 10 times since July of 2021 has Donald Trump's committee accounted for less than 10% of the money raised on Win Red during a single day. And 9 of those instances came in March of 2022, the last month that data was available. The vocal opposition is no longer just confined to anti-Trump forces inside the Republican Party. Out is also evident in the pro-Trump mainstream. When a triumphant Brian Kemp, whom Mr. Trump had targeted because he refused to go along with his efforts to subvert the 2020 presidential election, arrived in Nashville, Tennessee on Thursday to speak before a gathering of the Republican Governors Association, he received a standing ovation. There is this temptation to engage in wish-casting in which this is the moment in which Trump is slipping, said Charlie Sykes, a conservative anti-Trump commentator. On the other hand, what happened in Georgia was significant. He drew a bright red line, and voters just stampeded across it. Mr. Sykes said the current GOP very much remains Donald Trump's party, even as he saw a distinction between Trumpism and Donald Trump himself. The critical question, as he put it, is whether Republican voters are in a let's-give-him-the-gold-watch-and-let's-move-on mood. Mike Pence, whom Donald Trump publicly condemned as rioters swarmed the Capitol during the certification of the 2020 Electoral College vote, has made travels to early states. A favorite of evangelical voters, he has sought to highlight his support for ending abortion rights as the Supreme Court prepares for a possible decision undoing the landmark Roe v. Wade ruling. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, a Republican who has been a hawk on immigration and China since before the Trump presidency, has positioned himself as a potential heir to Trumpism. Tom Cotton has also drawn a contrast with Mr. Trump from the right, vocally criticizing the First Step Act, a criminal justice reform bill that the former president signed into law as a liberal law. Two former top Trump administration officials, Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley, the former United Nations ambassador, are making endorsements, traveling and building up their political infrastructure. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina recently announced another trip to Iowa and has been investing heavily in his digital fundraising operation. Tim Scott has said that this will be his last term in the Senate, but he continues to pad a $23.4 million campaign treasury despite facing only token opposition. Mr. Scott has more than 1,000 times as much money as his closest rival, a Democrat with $23,199. Even some of Trump's allies, like right-wing media host Stephen Bannon, speak for a swathe of one-time Trump voters when they condemn the coronavirus vaccines that Donald Trump championed while president. Numerous Republican strategists have argued that Mr. Trump's continued obsession with the 2020 election is an unwanted distraction in 2022, when Democrats hold the levers of power in Washington, and opinion polls show most of the country feels like the nation is moving in the wrong direction.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.